Hey, you. Want access to exclusive secret ops intel? Check out the link in the description.
AI is not going to take your job. Somebody using AI is going to take your job, right? So use AI, learn to use AI. That is a critical skill at this point.
Welcome to Secret Ops, the podcast uncovering the world of operations, one episode at a time. I'm your host, Ariana Caffone, and today's guest is Hikari Sanju, CEO at OmniKey, which is an AI platform that helps to generate, analyze, and optimize personalized ad creatives at scale. So we're talking about advertising today and AI, in particular, generative AI. So if you know nothing about this, that is the right episode for you to listen to. Without further ado, let's jump in. Hikari, thank you so much for coming into Secret Ops. It's wonderful to have you here because we're dipping into topics that we haven't dove into before. One being advertising. We've done marketing, but advertising is its own niche. We're also going to talk about generative AI and what the heck that means and all that good stuff. But I want to kick off with something in the spirit of the Summer Olympics, which is I saw that in your background, you did fencing. And I have to ask about it because, first of all, from the outside, I've never seen fencing in real life, but it looks so cool. I can imagine a lot of the things that you're doing within that realm also translate into the business world and being an entrepreneur. Just to kick off, where did that passion come from? How long did you do it for?
Yeah, fencing. It was initially kind of like an activity, I think, at a friend's birthday. And then, but it just happened that the club that we went to for this event, the coach was actually really good. He was like the national, U.S. national coach. And so it was really just pure happenstance that I picked up fencing in high school and got really into it. Won some national events and was a nationally ranked fencer in high school. And then I actually walked on to the fencing team in college at Harvard. And so it was me and a bunch of recruited athletes and, me being recruited, not recruited, I was essentially doing all the practices, waking up at 4 a.m., running across, running in the cold Boston winter, going to practice twice a day from four, like 5 a.m. to 6 a.m. and then after class as well. And it definitely develops a discipline and a certain pain tolerance, which I think does translate into entrepreneurial, into the entrepreneurial world. I think there is, something to be said that a lot of successful entrepreneurs are athletes. Mm-hmm. And, you do develop endurance and pain tolerance and competitiveness and drive and this, desire to win that does keep you going. So you inevitably face obstacles in business. And I think the other big thing to be said is that, I heard this quote recently, I think it applies so much to entrepreneurship, is that like good teams always figure out ways of getting out of holes. There was something to be said that, good entrepreneurs, good athletes, in any given situation, even when the odds are stacked against them, even when, the situation turns against them, they don't use that as an excuse and they figure out a way to kind of get back on track. And I think that mentality of like, whatever obstacle you face, I'm going to, overcome this. That mentality, I think, applies both elite athletics and also for entrepreneurship.
Absolutely. And a lot of it too is, it's like that thing where if you focus solely on one thing, sometimes it's impossible to see your way through that one thing. But if you start to do other things in your life, it's like the concept behind having a shower thought, right? Like go and take a shower because then your mind will finally be off the thing that you were thinking about. And all of a sudden the solution comes right to you. And it seems like with entrepreneurs, that's a huge part of it, right? You have to be multifaceted, but also that can be advantageous in solving problems. By wearing different hats, you can see through different apertures. And I think this gets to, like you said, was it your junior year in college that you started your first startup? So out the gate, you had a lot of these qualities to see a problem and begin to solve it. So can you break that down for us, especially because it comes down to the thing that you were doing in school? You were learning and you were wanting to help others learn through tutoring. So talk to me about what you were seeing and why you started your first business in college when many people aren't doing those kind of things.
Yeah, so I saw this market inefficiency in college where you have really great smart PhD students who are often making minimum wage or less as part of their program. And then you have, all their students as well who are working to make ends meet, pay for college, et cetera. And you have a humongous supply of educational demand from other students in the Boston region. So it was kind of like an Uber for tutors. So that was really the initial impetus of starting my previous ed tech company was this inefficiency between, you know, demand for help with homework or studying, and then the excess supply of people who could help with that, who are potentially making less money doing other stuff.
Now, interesting, because I also come from the educational technology background as well. And I found teaching technology or education and technology to be so hard. It's such a hard thing to do because, first of all, it's changing very, very quickly. Secondly, connecting the right people to get the right information it's like a matchmaking service. You're trying to find the right person to fit the right needs. When you were creating this first business, how did you evolve that over time? Initially, was it just like, all right, let's just try and match people up based on price point, and then eventually went to skill set? Or how did that become more and more nuanced as the business grew and eventually was acquired?
Yeah, EdTech is notoriously difficult. And, you know, I think college students generally start one of three companies. They start either a dating app, a food delivery app, or a tutoring app. The tutoring business is by far the least lucrative. And you know, there are big names in the dating side and the food delivery side. But there's not as many big names on the education side because it is a tough market. And fundamentally, you're competing against, you know, a free service, which is government-funded education, which is great that exists. And so what we ended up doing is, you know, initially it was an app to connect students with tutors in person. It was this like local mobile, it was following this local mobile social trend so that you can see if you were mutual friends with this tutor, you could see if they were, you know, you'd only mess people in the vicinity and then you'd meet up with them for tutoring. That said, there was this inherent churn problem because once a student meets a tutor in person, they don't really depend on the app anymore. And that actually exists, I think, for most high trust products. So it applies for tutoring. It also applies for things like house cleaning, right? Those businesses also have high churn because once you meet somebody, you know, why would I keep paying a certain margin percentage to a platform when I can just pay somebody directly? Also regarding supply and demand, getting that to work efficiently, it, you know, might work in an area like Boston where there is a lot of demand and supply for students and tutors, but you leave the large cities or large college towns and, you know, it's harder to kind of create that liquid market of students and tutors. So we ended up also connecting students with tutors virtually as well through chat. And so college students and tutors can connect via chat. And that's really also where we started getting into this realm of, you know, and now you're seeing this with like the AI tutors and such and the chat-based tutors. But, you know, at that time, the technology wasn't there yet. So what we ended up then pivoting to was there's a huge demand of tutors in Asia that are willing to spend a lot of money for tutors from Harvard or the top Ivy League schools or top schools in general. And so we ended up then pivoting the business to then supplying these tutors on our platform. And that's kind of how we got to a certain revenue margin. But yeah, we ended up selling the company to another ed tech company in the Bay Area where I led marketing and growth.
Now you started this quite young, right? So you're in school, you're pursuing your degree in computer science. You're also starting the startup that gets acquired. And now you're on to OmniKey, which is your latest business venture. I can imagine the lessons that you're learning is just one after the other, probably like more than a dozen lessons a day on one part of the business, whether it's technology or whether it's being an entrepreneur, or in this case with OmniKey, it's about advertising. So what did you learn about the world of advertising that you wanted to solve with OmniKey?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it dives also into my passion as in generative art. So I studied computer science at Harvard with a focus on AI. My dad's a painter. And so when I saw the early generative AI models in college, that got me very excited about technology because the idea that AI could be creative, I found incredibly compelling and just something that I just got really obsessed with, like just inherently in terms of the technology. And I was playing around with these various kind of open source embeddings and models. And simultaneously, I'm running marketing at the Acquire. And it was really there connecting those two things of, and this is a fundamental problem we're solving in OmniKey, because there was a data point that came out that 55% of marketing budgets are wasted on ineffective content. And that's a lot of money because advertising is a $1 trillion industry. And so that's $500 billion, you know, in potential advertising budget being wasted on ineffective content. And then there's this generative AI thing that I was following very closely in generative art in particular. And I was saying, like, connecting those two pieces, like, well, this could really help solve this other problem. And on top of that, I think there's another key component, which is data-driven design. And that computer vision is advancing very, very quickly in terms of the ability to identify objects in images. And that as a designer, there historically had not been a really great tool for quantified design. So there's not a really great tool for saying, okay, well, I chose this color over this color, and why did it perform better? And rating computer vision to quantify design, to add data to the design process, and then generative AI to then generate the content against those insights. That was the initial idea behind OmniKey, which got me to start the company back in 2018.
So how have you navigated understanding what needs to stay with humans versus what can be technically solved, and then communicating and educating people on why they should try that?
Right. And it really dives in exactly into the operation, the creative operations today. And the it's very siloed. So in a marketing department or in a company, there tends to be the media buying team or the marketing team, and then there's the creative team or the design team. And they don't really talk to each other very much. Maybe they talk to each other once a month, and they don't talk to each other in a very deep way at most places. It's very bifurcated. Creative creates, maybe they'll create ads every week or every month. They'll throw it over the wall to the marketing team. The marketing team is stuck with their creative. They have to run those creatives, and they're seeing results, and that's it. And there's not very much, a whole lot of communication between these two teams. I mean, they speak different languages fundamentally. Marketing speaks in the world of conversion rates and data, and then marketing team talks about, you know, it's in the realm of feelings and stories, and 55 to 75% of your performance is based on the creative. So as a marketer, your job depends on the creative. Like, how good the creative is and how good the creative is personalized literally makes a difference between whether you achieve your goals or you surpass your goals or you don't achieve your goals. And yet they have very little say today in terms of what creative they run, or they don't have a whole lot of oversight in terms of that. They don't even know how to communicate necessarily that to the creative team. And then as a creative, you're not given a whole lot of guidance from marketing in terms of what's actually working. Like, you know, as a designer, I'm like, I gave this team creative, you know, like, I have no idea, you know, how it's doing, what's doing well, why it's doing well. Like, they want feedback too in terms of their work, how it's doing, but they don't get a whole lot of that either. They don't get a whole lot of visibility in terms of why it's performing and what they can do to make it better. And this is because there hasn't really been a design analytics platform to translate design into insights. And so what we do with our tool, and this dives into our positioning, is we empower the creative team with the insights from the marketing department, but in a language they understand, which is, these are the colors that are working, these are the image entities that are working, these are the stories that are resonating. We use, you know, the ability for an AI to explain an image or a video to discover trends for the designer, to create more effective content based on the data. And then we also create a way for the marketer to quickly generate new marketing ideas based on, and creative ideas based on their data. So that the creative brief that they send to the marketing department is data-driven and also pretty robust in its ideation, because historically, sometimes a lot of the guidance that a marketing team may give to a creative team is literally just, these are the dimensions of the advertising assets, this is the product, this is the discount, send me something that fits these things. And that's not a lot of guidance to give a creator, so or a creative designer. And so this gives, you know, more guidance, like, what's the story, what's the main value prop, and what is the description of the image. And then we'll actually even generate sample ads like this that include these features that they can send as kind of a mood board to the designer. And also we'll generate the templates and the multivariations of those as within our tool as well, if the marketer just wants to run with these designs, or have the designer be able to work off these generative templates to kickstart their design process. And so it's a tool that interfaces with both the marketer and the designer.
Now, I can imagine that user testing is a vital part of building your product, because I find AI to be a crapshoot sometimes. Sometimes you hit the mark times a million, and sometimes you're so out of left field, you don't even know how to get back to home base. So how has user testing fueled and changed the way that your product is created?
Oh, that's a great question. And I totally agree with you, right? AI, I'd say, is not good enough on the first shot to generate something that is useful oftentimes. There's an element where you need a human in the loop. And so this is really where our whole workflow comes in. We have an approval dashboard where users can provide feedback on the creative, say, you know, it's missing these features, or we need these other elements, or this is not on brand. you have a whole brand management feature product platform where customers upload their brand guidelines, they upload their brand books, they upload all their brand assets, they can upload all their connect all their historical advertising and marketing content, and we build a model to understand and build a model based on the brand. Because you know there are a lot of restrictions depending on the industry of what you can and can't say. And this feature includes capabilities like, you know, these are the words you can't use, or this is the imagery you can't generate. And every time a customer provides feedback on the ad in the approval process, that gets updated into the brand management feature as well. So therefore, it's constantly iteratively learning what makes that brand unique and what is the essence of that brand. And so then the next time we generate content, it's more aligned with the brand and is more brand safe. But it is a constant work in progress because also the underlying technology is constantly improving and changing. We have Llama models now that make any, you know, and we offer this to customers where they can fine tune a Llama model on their brand voice and generate on brand copy.
What is a Llama model? I haven't heard of that. What is that? I'm imagining a Llama, a four legged creature, and I don't think that's what this is.
Yeah. So Llama is an open sourced model that was released by Facebook, by Meta. And essentially, it's democratized large language foundation models. Before Llama, everything was a closed platform. So if you wanted to generate content, you know, with an AI, you had to use one of the handful of APIs, like ChatGPT's API, or Microsoft's API, or but you couldn't really fine-tune a model on your own data. You couldn't keep the data yourself. You had to send the data to a third party, and you're very reliant on these closed platforms. What Llama 3 enabled any business to do is that as long as you had GPUs, you could build your own foundation model and fine-tune that model to reflect your company or your brand or your data in a better way and not send data to a third-party provider or to a third-party cloud if they didn't want to.
Why did Meta release that? Why did they want that outside of just obviously open source being adoption? Is that part of it, of course? But I don't know. That seems like a lot to give to the public.
Yeah, it's a great question. And Mark Zuckerberg wrote a really great blog, you know, post on this. The, you know, Meta has been open, you know, they've open sourced a lot of great things in the past. And they've actually, you know, a lot of the infrastructure we use today, like PyTorch or React, I mean, these are from. And then the idea is that if you open source your technology, there are benefits because then it becomes the standard. If you open source technology and everyone uses it, then it becomes a standard and then it improves your own underlying infrastructure. So Meta is using their own large language models to power their chatbot within their apps. And so then now we have the global developer community improving their chatbot as well. And unlike other companies like you know, the other big tech companies, the cloud providers that need to make money from selling API access to large language models, Meta doesn't have a business like this. So for Meta, it hinders their competitors. These are the other, you know, advertising platforms or cloud platforms, the big tech companies, and it benefits their underlying technology and infrastructure because they make their money entirely from advertising, which does not get cannibalized at all. And if anything, open sourcing this and improving this underlying technology improves their advertising business. And so for them, it's a win-win. And so that's why I think those are some of the reasons why I think they open source this model.
That's so interesting. I was curious because it's always, you're always wondering why people make things open source. Why do they give things for the public? Some people are just doing it for the good of adoption and the good of progress. But then when you see larger companies doing it, you're like, what is the other angle here? But I guess this, you know, transitions slightly to, when we're talking about smaller businesses, so that's a lot of the companies that I work with, smaller, medium-sized businesses. When it comes to generative AI, where do you recommend they start?
Advertising is kind of a scary industry where you're seeing a lot of money being spent and sometimes you don't see a whole lot of results and it's like, is this working? Am I just burning money? And so I would start by try running ads yourself with a very, very limited budget, you know, and just kind of learn what is involved in advertising. It is kind of an esoteric and somewhat complicated industry that does kind of power the underlying financial infrastructure of the web and kind of the internet. And so with a small budget, that way, you know, at least you understand a little bit of the how we can help you with. And then separately, when it comes to generative AI, I would try generating some images on, and then, you know, seeing the quality of the generated images, and, you know, probably you would have to edit them with some editing tool, and then trying to run that as ads and see the work that's involved in that process today as well, and realize that there is probably an easier way, and we can help you with that as well. And so, yeah, those would be my suggestions.
That makes sense. I feel like when it comes to AI, creativity is key in its application. And so the more that we have tools that people who aren't technical can use when it comes to generative AI, just anybody who doesn't have that developer or computer science background, the more that we can see how the applications really could come to life. I mean, I will give an example. My parents are in their set, and I did some like photographs of them, paintings, old style, all of that. Not only did they love it, but I also think for them, it was a door into a new world of what's possible today, when a lot of it can feel really overwhelming. If you can make it personal, if you can make it creative, if you can also leave some money to just experiment, in doing so, you're going to be able to get into that world faster than if you're just staring at it from the outside, not getting your hands dirty, trying the thing. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, definitely play around and experiment with every AI tool you can get your hands on. I mean, at the end of the day, AI is not going to take your job. Somebody using AI is going to take your job, right? So use AI, learn to use AI. That is a critical skill at this point.
I guess I want to leave with one question before we wrap up, which is, you know, for those listening who might be overwhelmed or just completely, I guess, at a paralysis of where to begin with AI in general, what's a fun tool or a really approachable things that they can do to just dip their toe into it?
So there's a handful of these great large language models that are out there. You can just kind of search them, the chat apps, the large language model apps, and ask it to write emails for you and ask it to write blog posts for you and ask it to generate images for you for your daughter's birthday or, you know, for like a barbecue you have this weekend or, you know, create games. I had a friend who creates some card games using generative AI.
Hey, listener, do you want to be a top operator in business and in life? Well, we at Secret Ops are here to help you do just that. Check out our monthly Secret Ops newsletter with exclusive intel just for you. From bonus content to secret resources, we've given you the VIP access. To sign up, check out the link in the description. And as always, thanks for listening.